the bread. Let's invite Will up. That was a very solemn. Let's welcome Will.
Good morning. It's really lovely to be here with you this morning. My name is Will. I have done quite a few Good Friday sermons in my time. I used to work as a pastor at Narara Valley Baptist Church. And Easter Sunday is normally like, that's the prized spot, right? So I got given a lot of Good Fridays, which I always compared to, it's like the Empire Strikes Back sermon. You get the fun of talking about death. And then the Return of the Jedi sermon was always like, you know, it's the senior pastor's job. So very generous of Christine to invite me to finally fulfill my dream of having a Return of the Jedi sermon. There's kind of a bit of a joke that a lot of Baptist pastors like to do three-point sermons, often that alliterate, you know. Christine is way too eloquent and creative for that, so you might not get many of those around here. I'm going to do a three-poem sermon because I'm a bit more of a poet than a preacher, but we'll kind of find our way through a bit of poetry, a bit of storytelling, and see how we go. This is the book Christine was mentioning. It's called Poems for When the World is Ending, because it's ended a lot of times in the last few years, it seems. But this poem is called The Apocalypse Next Door. The world is always ending for someone. There is always an apocalypse next door. You don't need X-ray vision to peer beneath the skin of things. Across the road from my house, a woman paces, mumbles, yells words I will not say in a church, at a world gone mad. Encores of this dramatic monologue she has performed many times for the red and yellow littered bins lined up and listening. I tell myself she is a little off. But perhaps her response is the logical one in a world of everyday apocalypses. It's easy to dismiss the long lineage of doomsday sayers who got their dates mixed up. But maybe their dates were correct. Their prophecies just lacked particularity. The end of the world plays on repeat. Some babes are born without heartbeats. Others raised by hard streets get caged like sardines before the age of 18. Young trans lives take early exits in the wake of dehumanizing, venomous rhetoric. Forests razed, habitats in tatters to maintain unnecessary and excessive human habits. The world is always ending for someone. Thing is, though, you can watch it broadcast live from across the road, or you can enter into someone else's apocalypse and let them know they're not alone. How many ways can the world end? And I wonder, like, if you think about the end of the world in your two shoes, what kind of images that might bring to mind. You know, someone's world might feel like it's ending when their house burns down. Someone's world might feel like it's ending when a relationship ends or when a child is lost. I was speaking a while ago with a friend of mine named Rob Waters. He's a Gumeroi man. And we're talking about all the different ways that the world can end. And he said to me, if you want to know how to survive the apocalypse, speak to some Aboriginal people, because our world ended, and yet we're still here. We're still surviving. We know how to survive the apocalypse. This story about the Emmaus Road, and really, for all of the followers of Jesus, you know, after Good Friday, there was a day or two that probably felt like the world had ended. Like there was this radical movement, grassroots movement that had started from the fringes and the edges, this beautiful revolutionary way that Jesus came and taught. And yet it seemed like it had been publicly shamed, humiliated, crucified, and ended by the empire. It seemed like this grassroots movement of love had been put in its place and squashed, and it probably felt a little bit like the world had ended. And for us, you know, we kind of know about Easter Sunday. We think about Easter as this kind of complete picture. So we have a different vantage point on the story. We have an empty tomb, empty chocolate eggs. We know that that grassroots movement from the fringes and the edges took root and continued and continues. It has had a messy and complex history, and some of it is really ugly. Sometimes it looks almost unrecognizable from the teachings of its rabbi. And yet, this is a quote from G.K. Chesterton, which I love. He said, "Christianity has died many times and risen again, for it had a God who knew the way out of the grave." You know, here on Easter Sunday, it's easy to come and celebrate resurrection and to celebrate what it looks like when the end of the world is reversed, and to celebrate that every ending might actually be a beginning in disguise. You know, we know how to do that. We get to say today that sin and injustice and death do not get the last word. And often on Easter Sunday, we do that really triumphantly. And, you know, we celebrate, and it's appropriate to celebrate this idea of resurrection and new life and an empty tomb. And I don't want to be too much of a buzzkill. I don't want to get in the way of that too much. But today I kind of want to actually ask the question, what does it mean to celebrate Easter Sunday when the trauma of Good Friday and the silence of Easter Saturday still linger? What does it mean to have an understanding of the resurrection that makes sense of the fact that sometimes it still feels like we're in the wilderness, even on Easter Sunday? So I do apologize. This might be the saddest Easter Sunday sermon you've ever heard. But you know, it's so easy sometimes in our celebration to try and bypass the realities that still remain. And I actually don't think that's what God or what Jesus asks of us. So yes, let's celebrate death defeated and an empty grave and a God who responds to the worst in us with love and forgiveness. Let's celebrate that. But let's also make space for what may linger with us from Good Friday and the silence of Holy Saturday, because those things don't just kind of disappear always on Sunday morning. On a calendar, it's really easy to see the difference between Friday and Sunday, isn't it? Because there's Friday, there's Sunday. Real life isn't always like that, is it? I mean, maybe yours is. Mine isn't. In reality, I find that they are much more interwoven. You know, death and resurrection, the dying and rebirthing, these things are often kind of interwoven and integrated with each other. And these two friends walking this road to Emmaus in this story, they walk in the presence of the resurrected Christ, and yet they're still replaying the events of the past. And in this story, they are in a present moment with Christ, and they're also in a past moment, downcast, thinking about all that has happened. And that's actually at least one way of describing psychological trauma, is to be in a present place, replaying a past place. It can feel like the wilderness that you have been talking about, the silent aches of Saturday, is kind of never ending. Or it can feel like we find ourselves in places where maybe we should have shaken that off and maybe we should be able just to be here and celebrate, but it still feels like we're replaying the trauma of Good Friday. In recent years, many of us may have heard the phrase, "the body keeps the score." Has anybody read this book from a guy named Bessel van der Kolk? He's a psychologist. "The body keeps the score." If you're not familiar with it, the idea is that there's all this research now that shows that after a psychological trauma, after some traumatic event happens in a person's life, it doesn't just go away and it doesn't just live in their brain, it lives in the body. And it can be years later when, you know, there's kind of ongoing physical ailments as a result of psychological trauma, which I think is part of just the wonderfully interwoven and complex way that we are made as human beings. But, you know, isn't it profound that this is also true of the resurrected Jesus? When Jesus comes back on Easter Sunday in a resurrected body, he still has the scars. He still has holes in his hands and marks in his side. And he actually bears the scars, the traumas of what has happened. When Jesus asks Thomas to place his hands in the holes left in his palms from the nails of crucifixion, it is as if Christ is saying, even though I still carry the wounds of the past, I am here now, a divine trauma survivor. I host a podcast called Spiritual Misfits Podcast, and the church that we kind of lead back home on the Central Coast is kind of for people who feel like misfits, many people who wouldn't sort of be in a church otherwise. And the podcast is kind of our attempt at expanding that conversation for people that we can't fit in our lounge room where we usually gather. But I recently interviewed an incredible human being, a survivor of PTSD named Becca D'Souza. Anyone here listen to the Spiritual Misfits podcast? A couple people. Anybody listen to Becca's story a few weeks ago? I strongly recommend it. But I'm going to give you the best bits anyway. Then go and listen to the rest of it. But here's what Becca had to say. She says, I am a survivor, not only of physical trauma to my body, but I am also a survivor of my own post-traumatic response. And this is where I have met Jesus, again and again. Jesus hasn't rescued me from my body in exchange for a spirit. Jesus has shown me what it means to be at home in a body that bears the scars of a crucified world. Jesus is also a trauma survivor who comes to us with his own scars of body and heart and invites us to survive in him. When I think about the Easter story in this light, it takes on all kinds of new resonances. In case you haven't been paying attention, the last couple of years have been fairly traumatic on planet Earth. And you may have found yourself thinking, well, things are kind of back to normal now, but I don't quite feel like I'm back. Anybody felt that? Anybody felt like, oh, you know, maybe not wearing masks much and we're in the building together and things are kind of back, but I don't quite feel like how I did pre-COVID, fire, flood, you know, whatever else happened in your life anyway, the regular shocks of being human. Yeah, that makes sense because there's a lag between the event and how we process it. I've done quite a bit of work in resilience over the last couple of years, and I got to speak to a psychologist in Melbourne named Rob Gordon. And Rob Gordon is sort of, he spent his whole career going into communities that have experienced traumas, bushfires, floods, cyclones, you name it. And he says that people often think about the first disaster, but they don't think about the second disaster, which is what happens when those things catch up to us. So I think about this Easter story and I think, well, maybe we're a little bit like on the Emmaus Road, where maybe we live on Resurrection Sunday, where Christ has been risen. We live in the light of a new day, and yet maybe our bodies and our minds take a while to catch up, and that's okay. You know, I think of trauma survivors in our church community who are part of a healthy, loving, safe community, and yet many of them have had experiences of spiritual abuse or being in churches that have been traumatic for them. And it's interesting that even in a community that feels very different to that, there is still a caution, there is still a woundedness. I mean, there may be people in this room that can relate to that. And I think that makes sense of the Easter story and what it means to be human. I want to say to you that if you've been wandering through the wilderness, if you felt like whatever that may mean for you, you've been wandering through the wilderness and yet it seems like you're in what should be an oasis. It seems like maybe you're in a safe place or good community, but it doesn't always feel like that in your body. That's actually okay. That's actually affirmed in the narrative that we have of Jesus coming back with scars in his hands and his side. Resurrection doesn't instantaneously circumvent the gradual and holy work of healing and recovery that I think God wants to do in us and through us. And yet, resurrection is a promise at the same time that there is no trauma, no ache, no grief, no death that precludes us from renewed life and hope and embodiment. Resurrection doesn't necessarily give us a shortcut out of those things, but it also does mean that there is nothing I don't think that we can go through or face that may not have the seeds of renewal and hope and resurrection life in it. And I reckon that's good news. I reckon it's good news not just for those with the most confident faith. I reckon it's good news for those of us whose faith has a limp. It's good news for those who bear scars Jesus comes to us in an aching world in solidarity. Here's poem number two. Jesus came to me wearing the rocks and the water and the bark as skin. It seems he always comes in skin. I didn't notice at first until I saw the scars in his side, the marks inflicted by our addiction to the nails. I, like Thomas, came tail between my legs with questions. Is it really you? Have you swapped your donkey for a chariot yet? Are you here to divide the sheep and the goats? Jesus asked me to place my fingers in the wounds. I touched the fractured earth beneath my feet, a portrait of the weary Saviour we continue to exploit, to crucify, to praise. My Lord and my God, we touched skin to skin. Jesus wept, and I with him. You know, I think the Easter story continues. I think we continue to participate in crucifixions. I think we continue to be those who desire empire. And yet Jesus continues to come in skin that bears the scars and extends a hand and says, I offer forgiveness and life and renewal. My own faith journey often feels like a game of hide and seek. I don't know if anyone else can relate to this. I was taught to see God in certain places, and God was in those places, and then it seems like God is no longer in those places, and I'm still looking in those places, and then I go to other places where I've been told that God is not supposed to be, and it seems like I find God there. Have you ever experienced any version of this? It can feel like a big game of hide and seek, which isn't that kind, you know, but that's how it seems to be. But I don't think that I'm the only one who experiences that. And in fact, I actually have really enjoyed this year looking back through the Easter story and seeing all the moments where people did not recognize Jesus. There's obviously this Emmaus Road, sort of failure to recognize Jesus even while walking along road with him. Mary sees Jesus and thinks he is the gardener at first. The disciples see Jesus and think he is a ghost. And these all kind of remind me that maybe that's a normal part of faith, that sometimes we actually are in the presence of the divine, we are in the presence of Christ, we are in the room with Jesus, and yet we are unable to recognize it. Eventually, in all those examples, they do recognize it. Mary sees that the gardener is Christ. The disciples see that it is an embodied Jesus and not just a ghost. On the road to Emmaus, these two followers of Jesus, they say, didn't our hearts burn within us now that we recognize who it was? And it changes how they looked back at their experience. When they were in the moment, there was a lack of recognition. And then they saw Jesus was with us that whole time, even when we didn't feel like it. And so I want to say to you that if you ever exist in the doubt and the despair and the disbelief, Jesus is there with you, just like in these stories. And maybe we will come to look back at those moments and see that our hearts were actually burning within us as we were brought into places of healing and life and hope. But sometimes it takes a while to recognize. And I think that maybe for most of us, the work of faith is less about trying to strain to bring about resurrection and maybe learning to look for where it is already happening and we have not yet recognized it. So earlier I mentioned Becca D'Souza, who I did this podcast interview with. I want to quickly share with you a little bit more of her story and an image that she shared with me for God that I have found incredibly helpful. And if you forget everything else I say this morning, I reckon this is the best image to take. But to give you a bit of context, Becca was involved in a bus accident while she was working in an overseas context, doing kind of overseas missions work. And the bus had 17 people on it, ran into a truck, and there were 8 people who survived, and everyone else died. And of those that survived, some have had long-term disability, and all of them, including Becca, have certainly had both physical and mental PTSD. Until this point in Becca's story, she had a faith that was very confident and very much believed that God was in control of every moment and everything was all part of God's good plan. After being involved in an accident like that, you start to ask questions like, really? Was God in control when the bus hit the truck? And when, you know, 9 of my friends passed away all in one go, was God in control of that? Did God cause that? And as Becca has wrestled with those questions over the years, you can hear more about how she shares. But, you know, she believes, as I would believe, that a non-coercive God of love is actually not in control of every moment, but that God is present in every moment and that God is doing all God can as the good, infinite God of love in every moment. And so the image that Becca shared with me is that she likes to see God as a midwife. She says that the midwife is there in the room where the birth is happening. The midwife is present. The midwife is incredibly wise. The midwife offers different solutions when things get stuck. The midwife is encouraging and championing. But the midwife is ultimately not the one who births the baby. But the midwife is there to guide and lead and encourage and to be there when things don't work out as we would hope. And she says, maybe God is like that. And maybe that God comes alongside us. And God wants to birth things in this world, in us and through us. But God will not do that without us. That the God that we have, maybe rather than the God that we sometimes wish we had, the God that we have is one that comes alongside and says, let's do this together, and allows us to be a part of ushering in resurrection and renewal all around us. So a question maybe to take from today is, what does God want to birth in and through and with you, individually as well as a community here? And what does it look like to live a life that participates in the thing that God is doing, the thing that God is birthing, and affirms that resurrection is not just something that happened 2,000 years ago, and not just something we hope for in some distant future, but that resurrection is what happens every single time we partner with the God who knows death and suffering and grief and trauma and brings the scars of these things and yet comes alongside us and brings renewal and redemption and reconciliation and resurrection. You know, to live a life that affirms the resurrection, in my mind, is to participate in that every moment. Say, what resurrection might there be here, now, in my community, in my life, in this body? How can I partner with this divine midwife birthing beautiful new things? Let me share one last poem with you, and then I will go back to my seat. This is a poem called All Things New, and it kind of, I guess, summarizes everything I was just speaking about. So if you weren't listening, hopefully the poem does the job. I hold some words in the pockets of my well-worn soul. I pull them out when I'm slipping through my own sense of control. I hold them tight between my fingers, and I take a deep breath. And as oxygen expands my lungs to push against my edges, and I empty myself, let go, become defenseless, I bring these words to my tongue to taste if they're still true. 6 simple words, I am making all things new. But at first, those words taste like Never Never Land. Like, is this plane gonna ever, ever land? I get new pain, but my hope feels secondhand. Do you know what it feels like when everything is just a gradual falling to pieces? It's all cracks and creases, all fragmented pieces raining down around us in no logical sequence. And I honestly wonder at times, like, why are we still here? If there's a new thing to come, this could all just disappear. And maybe this universe would be better without us. Sometimes I'm pretty sure this earth would be better without us. But then I'm reminded that every cell in my body testifies to resurrection. Every part has once passed and yet sparked new flesh, and this person standing before you is literally being made new. and the body I once wore when I tore others to pieces with my arrogant opinions I had attached to the name Jesus. Well, every part of that body is replaced over time. It becomes redesigned, realigned. I am becoming refined. And that seems about as real as grace gets. That the parts of yourself that you struggle to live with are the graves where new flowers are birthed in the image of the one who brings new from the bones of the old. We aren't discarded, we're told. We hold treasure like gold in the very fragile clay jars of yours and my souls. And make no mistake, this story isn't one of evacuated souls. It's an incoming kingdom, incarnate and whole, skin and bone, mud and mess. The creator of all things humbly dressed in this very flesh, bagged up dust that is etched with the imprint of God on our spirit-laced breath. And the design does not end with decay and death. Christ turned death to a palette to paint life from. And yes, all things will be turned inside out and wrung upside down, like the king of the cosmos wearing thorns for a crown, like life bursting forth from the valley of dry bones, like the meek ones inheriting the earth as their own. This all things new is not a whitewashed product from a distant manufacturing facility. This maker is a little more into sustainability. This new is the sword beaten into a plowshare, the barbed wire fence in the hands of a jeweler. It's genuine asylum to be found here and on Manus Island. It's love instead of violence. It's hope amidst the silence. It's a return to the true form that was originally inside us. So when you feel yourself slipping through your own sense of control, keep these words in the pockets of your well-worn soul. Hold them tight between your fingers and take a deep breath. I am making all things new. God is making all things new. And that includes you. Thank you. Thank you. It's been an absolute privilege to